Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
This is Radio City Talk.
You with Radio City Talk. My name is Mick Coyle. Welcome to Mental Health Monday. Thank you for checking out the podcast and thank you for downloading us. There is a really interesting and difficult interview to listen to today. It's the story of Carmel Gisanti. Now, Carmel lost her son Oscar at the age of 16 to suicide after an incident at a train station. Now, Carmel is really open and honest with her account and how she talks about Oscar's life and her own experience. Some of what she says might be difficult to listen to, but I hope you appreciate her time and her effort to tell her story. She's also campaigning for greater safety around train stations and railway stations, particularly those which are unmanned. And Carmel, as part of the interview, explains what that is all about. She's going to have a petition up and running very soon, and we'll get you all the details on our social media when it's up and running and if you want to sign it. Also, as part of this week's podcast, you can hear from David Ashton from the Liverpool Samaritans. There is a new campaign called Small Talk Saves Lives, which is about teaching people a way to speak to somebody who might be acting in a slightly different way at train stations and railway stations, people who might require a little bit of extra help, maybe an arm around their shoulder, a kind word, or simply asking how they're getting on. You get all the details as part of that interview as well with David Ashton coming up. But first up, we'll hear Carmel's story on Mental Health Monday on Radio City Talk.
Oh, gosh. Oscar was, he was 16 when he passed away. But as a child, he was so loving. He was a sensitive child, always full of life. And, you know, him and his sister were really, really close. It was only 10 and a half months apart. And so they just had a really normal upbringing. We were close as a family. We did everything together. He was bright. He was intelligent. When I looked at Oscar, I used to think, I'm not worried about him because whatever he does in life, he's going to succeed. And you always had that air around him because of just what he gave off. You know, people give an air of themselves, of their personality. That was his personality. He was successful in whatever he did. He found things easy, you know. He always made friends. He wasn't sort of someone that was sat in the corner, miserable. He always had a smile on his face. He was always dressed smart. His teachers used to look to see, well, what you're wearing today, Oscar. He'd go in with bow ties on. You know, he was confident in that way of being himself. So for something like this to happen out of the blue on a normal, it was a Monday actually as well that it happened. He went to school Monday morning and dinner time came home. But then by the evening, that was it. You know, he just walked out the house and it was just such a shock. You would never see it coming.
In terms of his life as it was, like you say, and I know in the inquest after his death, people talked about him in a way which, you know, he was happy-go-lucky, was a phrase, bright, bubbly, brilliant, all those things that you talked about. What can you tell us about that day? Must simply have just been the worst day that you could ever imagine.
Yeah, just as normal, Isabel gets up, Oscar gets up, they're getting ready for school. I was always there at home to do breakfast, to see my kids out of school. I was privileged because some parents don't get that. They've gone before they see the kids go. So I was always watch them walk out the door, say goodbye, check they're okay. And so that was just the normal day. It was my day off, actually, Mondays at that time. And Oscar left after Isabel, as always. And Isabel always slammed the door, but never shut it properly. So it'd always bounce open. And Oscar would always say, she never shuts that door properly, does she? You know, and he kind of giggled. So it was, you know, it was nice, a nice day. He came home at dinner time. I remember what I'd made him for lunch because we'd had a Sunday dinner the day before. And so we had leftover chicken. So we had chicken butties for dinner. And I remember that. And then he was fine. Nothing was abnormal. He was just dead chilled, and he went back to school and it was all good, as I thought. And then I went off to the bank to add some things to do, and then I'd locked the front door, so when I came home the door was open, so I knew one of the kids had come in. And I just shouted, it's just Mum, I'm just going up to my room, because I was finishing like financial things for the tax, it was the end of the tax year as well. And then there was no answer, but I seen Oscar's door locked, and that was normal as well, which everything was very normal. It was a normal day. He used to come home from school, go into his room, do his homework, and then he'd come out and look for food. You know, that was just normal. He'd always get his homework done out the way. His schoolwork was important. He'd get it done and then he'd come out and that was it. So I would never sort of go into the room. It's his space. As a 16-year-old boy, they need the privacy as well. So, you know, that was it. It was just, I didn't think anything of it. And then an hour later, because I was still upstairs sorting financial things, an hour later, Isabel pops home from college. She skips up the stairs. She's singing a really happy song. She's rapping it, actually, but she's not good at rapping either. She has a go, but she can sing. So she's doing this little rap song, and then she bursts into my door, opens the door and says, "And the princess is home," in this at the end of this rap. So I was giggling. So then I knew, yeah, it was definitely Oscar in the house before. It sounds crazy saying that like I didn't go round to check, but, you know, we were just so comfortable because we were fine.
Absolutely.
We thought we were all...
I think you're describing something which a lot of people will recognise as almost the, you know, the mundanity of everyday life.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But I guess then it was what happened after that moment which really changed things for you.
That's it. Well, me and Isabel were going off to a meeting that evening. So she just shouted to me, "Mum, can we have McDonald's before we go?" That's another normal thing to do, isn't it? And I was like, really don't like McDonald's every day of the week. So we tried to minimise it. And so we went off to get that. And I shouted to Oscar, "We're just going to go get Mackey's and we'll be back." And we come back. So we didn't shut the door. We didn't lock it. We just shut it. We goes off. He comes back. I knocked on the door, opened it, and he wasn't there. So I kind of thought, oh, well, that's a bit unusual because, you know, where's he gone type thing. You know, it's without locking the front door, which was I found really strange. So at that point then, I thought, well, I'll leave it there. And I just messaged him because we were late at this point. We had to rush. I was getting messages saying, "Where are you? We're all outside. You need to open up for us." So I left him this message to say, you know, "I've left Mackie's on the bed. I thought he just popped to see his friend around the corner," because his friends lived all really close. And and so we went off, never thought anything of it. I didn't, I did lock the door because I thought, because then if he comes back, he'll ring me if he hasn't, he hasn't got the key. And I was literally round the corner as well. I was in my salon, which was round the corner, so close, hundreds of yards, metres away, you know. So I still wasn't bothered at that point. You know, he was a good boy. It's nothing to be worried about when they are so good and behaved. Didn't have any problems with Oscar, no issues. So what am I going to worry about? And then we came back from the meeting and the door was locked. And we went in and it was about 9 o'clock now. And there was no, you know, it was like an eerie, eerie feel to the house when we walked in. And Isabel started crying straight away and she said, "Something's happened, I can tell. Something's not right in our house." And it was really bizarre because you think, how can that be, that eeriness of... And so I said, "Don't panic, let's have a look." So we went into his room to see, you know, we rang him. Then we seen that the phone was in the drawer. He didn't have his phone with him. So then it was a bit... how are we going to contact him now? So then we thought, right, we'll start ringing around his friends. We rang around his friends and they all went online. They were all trying to, find out who's seen Oscar, where he is. Is he in someone's house? So there was like a big search going on at this point. And then panic starts to go in because you're thinking, where and what has happened to my child that, you know, today was normal. And now we've got this big drama where there's been no arguments in the family. There's been nothing out the normal, and you know, you just take into another world of sort of, how's this happened? It's, you know, it was horrific.
To go from that normality there to that, that gut instinct that you had both as a parent, but also there was a you know, the sister's reaction as well. There was a gut instinct there that something wasn't quite right. How long was it then that the friends were looking around on social media that those conversations were taking place?
I would say that was about an hour. Yeah. And I'd rang my husband was working away. We'd only been married 10 months as well. My husband was working away. He'd gone back up northeast that morning to work. And I rang him and he just said, "Just ring the police." Because he knew that Oscar was so predictable in his ways. You knew what he was going to wear on what day. You knew where he was going to be at what time. You knew exactly what he was going to do. He was so predictable that, you know, it was lovely to have someone so predictable, because you felt that you could, you could trust someone who's so predictable. You know nothing out of the blue is going to happen. You know when they're going to tell you something. You know when there's something wrong. It was just, you know, Oscar didn't do things to hurt people or upset people. Yeah, awful.
And in terms of that evening, I mean, I can only imagine as a parent what you would be going through and trying to, you know, get to grips and, you know, with what might have happened as well. I almost don't want to lead you down this next couple of questions, Carmel, but in terms of sharing that story and finding out, was it a phone call that you received when you discovered what had happened to him, or was it a knock at the door?
I rang. No, because at this point we were all worried, because it wasn't normal for Oscar. I mean, it was only 10 o'clock at night at this point, I've got to say. And, you know, most 16-year-olds would still be out doing whatever and the parents wouldn't be concerned. But for us, it was you know when it's not normal. So I rang the 111 number, which is like a non-emergency, isn't it? So we rang that. Because I thought, I knew there's something wrong, but I'm not ringing 999, because that's not, you know, it's not the, I didn't see it as that urgent of what you're going to say if you ring 999. So I rang the 111 anyway, and they kept me on the phone for quite some time, and I still didn't click on the fact that someone's talking to me. And I'm telling them that, you know, well, it's might not be anything, but my son's usually home, and he's not home, and I'm a bit concerned. And then it was just... when they keep you on the phone for that long and they're talking to you and she's asking me, well, do you know what he was wearing? And you start thinking, oh, gosh, you know, he's missing. He's going to be now a missing person. But then when she said, oh, we'll send someone round, and she didn't put the phone down, she kept me on the phone the whole time. And then she said, can you tell me when the police arrive? I still didn't click on. But only looking back now, I knew she was keeping me there to make sure that, to keep me talking so I wouldn't be going on any social media, because it actually was posted on social media that they put it down that a man had died, you know.
And that's how a lot of people may have heard this story, that they heard that somebody had stepped in front of a train at a train station. And often people hear about that and their first consideration is, you know, delays, travel problems and so on and so forth. But this is the absolute human side of this, isn't it? That in this case, unfortunately, this was your son. I know at the inquest, the tributes toward him at the inquest were you know, so wonderful in terms of the warm words and the kind words from friends, from the school as well. And I just wonder whether or not when you were at the inquest, whether or not you had any preconceived ideas about what you were going to hear, about what you were going to hear about that day, and maybe, you know, the background to Oscar, maybe some of the feelings that he'd been having ahead of that day. Or were you already kind of building up your own picture, if you like, of what had been going on in his life?
I didn't really know what they were going to talk about at the inquest, if I'm completely honest, because I've never been to an inquest like this before. In fact, I'd never been to an inquest ever, because my dad died 11 weeks after and his inquest was 6 months after again, which was completely different because he was an old man and it was more natural. But with Oscar, I didn't really know what to expect. The train driver was not there. I don't really want to say too much about that in case she is listening, but I wanted to kind of say to her as well that, are you okay? And the fact that they weren't there, the train driver wasn't there, and I couldn't say that, I was a bit upset about that, you know. It was just, and the things that they talked about that I heard the students coming out with, because Oscar's friends were there giving information out as well. And it was hard watching young people go through this. It was just really heartbreaking, really, really heartbreaking watching it. Oscar had actually said to one of his friends a year before that he'd had suicidal thoughts, but I'm okay now. And if he'd have known what that actually meant and known what to say or who to say to, but just a passing comment and, but I'm okay now. You know, that's if anyone has ever had a suicidal thought and said, but I'm okay now, you need to ask more questions. But obviously his friend was only 15 why does a 15-year-old know that? You know, they're not taught it in school as yet. Maybe later.
And what a responsibility for that group of friends who, of course, lost one of their own as well, and then presumably in their own minds thinking about, you know, what they could have done, and obviously that reliving that conversation as well, and, you know, thinking, well, I thought I was doing the right thing. What a responsibility to take on as a 15-year-old, the idea that your friend would offer something like that. And yet, despite all that, as you say, your own experience and you know, your life at that point, things seemed to be normal.
Yeah. Yeah, he was really good. But, you know, he just, the smile on his face. I mean, you can see in the pictures, if you go online, you see, or, you know, Facebook or whatever, you see his face and you just think, wow, you know, he's just got this amazing smile and this charisma around him. And he also had friends that used to go up and talk to him about their mental issues, of their mental health problems, of them not eating. You know, some of the, he was very good with the girls. They'd all talk to Oscar. They could open up to Oscar. But the fact that Oscar then felt like he didn't have anyone really that he could open up to, you know, because they don't talk to parents about things like that. Isabel was there, his sister, and they were really close. But then I suppose he knew that if he opened up to Isabel, then Isabel would tell me, and then it's all out. So that's probably the scary thing about mental health, is when you do say it, it's out there. And maybe they're not ready. You know, people that are suffering, they don't want everyone to know.
Can I ask you about the memory stick? Was there a note that had been left that had been contained within that memory stick? Did you get a sense of when that had been written or prepared?
Yeah. I kind of, my feelings are, but I could be wrong, because you kind of just presume sometimes. I thought when he came home from school and went into the room where we would normally do homework, I think he wrote it then. But I could be wrong, because who knows when he wrote it? Really, we don't have, unless it's got a date on it, and it, you know, you can't say, can you? So we never knew. It could have been done a year before when he had those first feelings, when he told someone, you know, I'll never know.
Carmel, are you okay to stay with us just a few minutes longer as well?
Yeah.
Because Carmel's story's a really, really tragic one as well, but hopefully from it there might be something that we can take from it. Oscar's life, and we'll talk some more about that in a few moments' time here on Mental Health Monday. But Carmel Jansante is with us. We'll continue the conversation here on Radio City Talk, and we'll continue that conversation next.
Mental Health Monday on Radio City Talk. Tackling the stigma.
Yeah, it's Mental Health Monday. My name's Mick Coyle. We've got Carmel with us in the studio. She's sharing her son Oscar's story. She's been talking about the day that he died, and has been really open and honest about her experience. And Carmel, thank you for being so open and honest. I'm sure our listeners will absolutely appreciate kind of what you've gone through, even though they could never imagine it themselves. In the days after losing Oscar, we speak to many people on this programme who have had family members, losing family members to suicide, and the reaction that this, sometimes the stigma that comes around suicide, that people don't quite know how to talk to somebody, don't know whether or not they're allowed to mention it as well. What was your experience of people's reaction towards you?
Oh gosh, it was mixed. It was very mixed. I had a lot of people where they just wanted to come to the house. The front door kept opening and closing, opening and closing. When one person would come in, the next thing, as they were leaving, there was someone else walking behind them, and it was constant. I felt like in some ways we didn't get to grieve in the initial beginning, but we had to, because it was such, it was the community. It wasn't just Oscar and us, it was the whole community that felt it. So I felt I had to open the door and allow them to come in and, you know, feel the, because, you know, you just do it. You just, you know, support, isn't it? I don't know what I'd have done without it, to be honest. But then I had other people that never spoke to me again. I had a lady, one of my customers, and she sent me, bless her, because she probably didn't know how to deal with it. She sent me a card through the post with a stamp on it, with the postman posting it through the door. She literally lived at the back of my house. She could have done that herself, and she couldn't face walking down the street. So you get real mixed emotions of people. It's, you know, we're not taught what to do.
It's almost testament, you know, to that stigma that comes around suicide, that people think, well, you know, you've experienced a tragedy, you've experienced a loss, you know, and people almost talk like you've grown an extra head or something like that. And I think that idea that people, even though they were constantly coming through your door, presumably that was a tremendous sense of goodwill from your friends and your neighbours.
It was
just
amazing.
Thought, well, let's just make sure that somebody's always there.
Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah, because we couldn't believe. And they, you know, in that week, they had us laughing. I look back and think, how could I laugh in that first week? Because, you know, funerals are mixed emotions with everything, aren't they? You remember the good times, but you have to move on as well from that at some point. But that's the hard bit as well, moving away from things. But yeah, the initial bit of support was amazing.
And in terms of moving on, it seems like a strange choice of words because, of course, you know, you know, Oscar will be something you would never, ever forget. But presumably it comes to a point where you think, right, what's going to happen next in life? And it, rather than walking away, you
have to create a new life.
And I wonder whether how difficult that is without wanting to sort of partition off Oscar's memory and then think about that. But you want to keep him in your hearts. So obviously, you've got, you know, the family as well, the new marriage that you're obviously working on too. But campaigning is something that you've started on as well. There's an online petition as well.
That's right, yeah.
Can we touch on the idea behind that as well? Because I think it's something which I think a lot of people, when they hear about it, might start to think, oh, actually, that seems to make a lot of sense. You know, for the reason that we're talking about today, plus a whole host of other reasons as well. Just tell us about the online petition.
Well, the petition is to get sort of more security for where the unmanned stations are at railway stations. The Network Rail and all the other lines, they're doing everything. Samaritans are working really hard, the train and the staff, and there's a lot gone into supporting things of you know, getting everything sort of right to protect the public. But unfortunately, the unmanned stations are being left behind. And as much as I've had meetings with Network Rail over this, I just feel like because of the finances, they don't want to do it. To be honest, that's the truthful. What I personally feel, that's the issue behind it. It's going to cost a lot of money to do it. But these are the places. If they're unmanned and there's no staff there, how can someone then open up and talk to someone who might look vulnerable? You're then depending on the general public, which the general public are really good if they've been in contact with someone or affected by suicide. Someone will always go up if they have that feeling. But if there's no one on the platform, you know, there was one person on the platform when Oscar took his life, and he was a young boy, he was 16. Bless him. I think of him every day as much as I think of my own son because of what he witnessed that day, and nobody should witness that. So it's the petition is to prevent people taking their own life on stations like this.
Capenhurst Station is one that people will know, and people will know that a lot of the commuter stations outside of the main hubs are often unmanned, often at all times, where there's not specifically a ticket office where you go on and you buy it. So it's part of the issue that if there's nobody around, there's not somebody who would be able to say, are you feeling okay? I mean, the Small Talk Save Lives campaign from the Samaritans is
exactly
something we've been touching on, and our podcast listeners can listen to shortly after this. But in terms of that, if there is somebody there, there is somebody who would be trained in spotting those signs, who would be trained in being able to say, actually, that's not quite right. That doesn't strike me as somebody who's waiting here to go to the cinema or waiting here to go to work.
Yeah, that's right. And apparently when Oscar opened up and said to his friend a year previously, which we didn't find out about until after Oscar's death, obviously, because he didn't tell us. He said to him that when he felt like that, he used to go up quite regular and sit there. So I actually remember Oscar saying to me, I'm just going for a walk. And I thought, oh, that's really good, isn't it? Because walking's really good. Going out for a walk when it clears your mind, it helps you think. And I thought with the pressures of school, going for a walk, get a bit of fresh air, coming back doing schoolwork is good. I look back now and I can see what he did. That was the time when he was, you know, going up and monitoring and watching. So if there was someone there or the CCTV or there was barriers, you know, my actual, what I think would work is if there was gates. So nobody would be allowed on these platforms because it's unmanned. And then the CCTV could be, you know, where it picks up any movement. And then obviously if there's a movement on the screen, what's that person doing over there? Because if the gates are there, you're not supposed to be there. Stop the trains going through. It's, you know, it sounds simple, and it really is simple. But we're not going to stop fast trains, and that's a cert, because they're making them faster. We know there's so much money. I think it's $130 billion a week. 130 million a week, which is being spent to upgrade the tracks and the busy stations. But these little ones, you know, they need, people need protection. This is a public area. This is where public people stand. No train should go through at 80 mile an hour.
And in terms of that, what sort of reaction have you had from sort of the powers that be and the people who you might sort of turn to for support in terms of getting something like this off the ground?
Our local MP, Justin Madders, is really supportive. He wants it all sorted out. He's got children himself. He thinks a lot about the people in his constituents. He's such he's a gent. You know, he really is worth his weight in gold. He's amazing. And he wants it. He wants it so badly. But obviously, he was there with the meetings, and it's a lot of statistics, a lot of finance. And that's all you kind of get, these statistics. And I had to stop and say, hang on, you're talking about people who have died. These are people. These are, you know, it's not just a number. It's a person. It's a family. It's the friends. I worry about Oscar's friends. I think every one of them know what happened. It's in their head. So if they get to a certain point in their life and they're feeling a bit vulnerable, would they go and do the same thing? It's in their head. So we need, as a society, to sort of put these things in place. We need to do everything. It's the education, it's the protection, you know.
And I wonder whether or not, actually, if you looked at it from a safety point of view, that they would look at people in Oscar's situation, but I guess as well, you know, security in terms of people feeling safe on those things. You only need to see how close to you know, the yellow line that sits on a platform, how close that is to the actual platform edge in terms of people who have prams and pushchairs and things and so on and so forth. So if that can be used in the wider context as well, I think people absolutely will come on board. It might just give that extra push as well. But of course, absolutely, let's all focus on, you know, on that reason that you brought it up.
Well, that's it, that yellow line. To me, that yellow line doesn't do anything. What if you're blind? Then you're depending on your dog. Is the dog going to recognise a yellow line? I don't know, maybe the train, they probably are, but it's, you know, kids that are, they just see a yellow line, they might want to walk along it, you know, with one foot in step. You know, when you do that baby steps where you do one foot in front of the other, kids do, they play. So yellow line could be the yellow brick road for us all in some kids' head, couldn't it? It's just, I don't think it's going to stop. It's not a barrier.
And I know the petition, the first petition is about to get refreshed online. So what I'll do, I'll point people in direction of the website.
Okay.
When the petition is up there, we'll get it tweeted out and Facebooked out as well. TheOscarPhillipsFoundation.com. That's double L on Phillips as well. TheOscarPhillipsFoundation.com. And that's a registered charity as well, the OscarPhillipsFoundation.com. We'll get a link on our social media as well, so that once that's up there as well, that people can start supporting it, start sharing it as well. I know you've got Justin Madders on board as well, and hopefully we can get some people talking about that as well. Carol, thank you for your time. We really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for sort of sharing your story, being so honest as well. And we wish you all the best in terms of sort of what life has got in store for you now. Outside of this, what else are you working on?
We go around schools, to be honest. We try and sort of lift the spirits. I always remember Oscar coming home from school one day and he said, oh, we had this great inspirational speaker in school. And he told us about this Rory, and I can't remember what the other guy's name was, but he said there was so much, you know, giving the confidence out and just their story. And he said it was really inspirational. So I kind of thought to myself that worked with Oscar. So maybe that would work with other kids as well. So we go around the schools and try and sort of lift their spirits, give them the three things that we sort of talk about, is confidence, commitment and continuity. And the other one is communication as well. There's four, communication, because without communication, there's nothing. But the other things as well are what build resistance, you know, resilience. It's resilience, isn't it, of life. And those things will take you through. So we have someone that works with us as well, Kevin DeWall from The One Show, and he stands in front of the school. It's usually a school assembly, and he will talk about the, you know, the commitment and the continuity and confidence and how you will achieve so much. And it doesn't matter in life what you want to do, what you want to aspire to. It's having those things in life that support you. You know, you need things that to help you build through life, how to survive it in a way.
If people want to find out more information about the fantastic work that Carmel's doing, theoscarphillipsfoundation.com.
Radio City Talk. Tackling the stigma.
And that's Carmel's story on Radio City Talk. And what a story it is. Really emotional and really quite something. Thank you for her time and sharing that story here on Mental Health Monday. We touched on the conversation there, and I mentioned in the interview that we'd hear our interview with David Ashton from the Liverpool Samaritans. There is a campaign which has just been relaunched. You may have seen the TV adverts for it, actually, called Small Talk Saves Lives. And this is about spotting signs when people don't look like they're having the best of times, particularly around train stations. And Network Rail have been working with charities to try and come up with a way of training people, if you like, to learn how to speak to people and intercept, if you like, if there is something that they are intending to do at a train station, at a railway station. David Ashton will explain all as well. He's from the Liverpool Samaritans. He joined me in the studio to find out more about the Small Talk Saves Lives campaign.
Everyone knows about Samaritans and how long we've been around and how to get in touch with Samaritans, but really, everyone, you know, in day-to-day life can make that difference to someone, and that's why the campaign's called Small Talk Saves Lives. Because people, when they have the confidence to go and approach someone and simply ask how they are or introduce themselves and see what's on their mind, they can make the difference to the extent that it may interrupt somebody's suicidal thoughts at that point in time.
So this campaign's been launched promoting the message that suicidal thoughts can be temporary and interrupted by a simple question. This initiative commissioned a survey of 5,000 passengers, which found that the majority are willing to play a role in stopping suicides. More than four out of five, though, said they would approach someone who may be suicidal if they knew the signs to look for, what to say, and that they would not make the situation worse. 9 out of 10 think someone in need of support would find it hard to ask for help as well. There's a sense of goodwill included in that, David, which maybe hasn't been allowed to play out. How can Small Talk Save Lives and the campaign sort of get people involved, change some of those perceptions, get that goodwill into actual actions?
So this is all about increasing people's confidence in going over to speak to somebody, because I'm sure you'd agree, we all get a gut feeling when you can see there's something not quite right with how somebody may be behaving. And say we were walking along, as happened to me the other day, and a lady fell over on the street, you're straight over there to help someone up or see if they're okay. But when it's behavioural, people do need that confidence to approach people and just say, are you okay, or can I help you with anything? You know, because it's the way society is now, we don't talk to each other as much as we did anyway. Everyone's got their head down in their phones. Or, you know, people may feel it's an intrusion, but just having that confidence that when you get the gut feeling but something's not quite right, just being able to approach somebody and say, are you okay, or can I help, will make all the difference.
These are the signs that have been flagged up as part of the campaign. Standing alone and isolated, looking distant or withdrawn, standing on a platform a long time without boarding a train, displaying something out of the ordinary in their behaviour or appearance. People might say, oh, we're too engrossed in our own social media or our own lives now to interrupt. But actually, generationally, it's the British thing, isn't it? So, oh, it's none of my business. Mm. Nothing for me to do here, whether or not this is 2017 or whether it's 1977. It's been a traditional British thing to do, hasn't it, to leave people to it.
It is. We're very polite as a society, and we'll leave people to it, as you say. But by going over and approaching somebody and starting that conversation, you could save a life. And so on our YouTube channel today, there's a video being published, the story about Sarah, who was somebody who was considering taking those actions, but somebody approached her and interrupted. And as a result, Sarah managed to get the help that she needed and is pleased to still be here today.
So people will say, but what do you say? And it's about those interruptions, those interjections as well, the disruption of the mindset as well, which might actually be the thing that stops somebody taking that action.
That's it, because it's very easy to get in touch with Samaritans if people need help, but then for us to approach people who need help is a bit more difficult. But out and about, you may identify somebody. So in terms of what to say, I think the main thing is just being ourselves and having the confidence to approach somebody. So it can be as simple as, do you need any help? And that's something that was said by a man called Andrew in the northwest of England, and he saved somebody's life in this setting.
I guess the other thing is, what happens next? I know the Zero Suicide Alliance have got some new training, which they're announcing, I think, towards the end of this week, which is going to look specifically about how people can get trained up on this one as well. It's not about, I guess, though, people becoming counsellors in the way that, you know, Samaritans are counsellors. This is about engaging someone, isn't it, with human contact, and maybe a human contact which has been lacking in their lives.
Absolutely. And because asking for help can be really difficult. So I think in the statistics here, it shows a majority of people, maybe 9 out of 10, agree that it is really difficult to ask for help. So it does need somebody with the confidence to go over and interrupt and start that conversation. And that confidence is all about not needing to know what to do. It's just simply starting a conversation with somebody and seeing what they tell you. But from then on, say if it is in a rail setting, staff have been trained in how to help people in these situations. But it's not the staff's responsibility to interrupt somebody. It's up to us, you know, day-to-day members of the public to ask someone how they are. And even just telling somebody they can contact Samaritans, you know, it gives them that encouragement to get in touch.
So you're working with Network Rail, British Transport Police in regard to this one. So people are in that situation. Now they might think, well, once I've started talking to this man or this woman, whoever it might be, what happens then? But what you're saying then with the training, that those staff members would actually be trained to take the next steps on your behalf?
Yeah, so since 2010, Samaritans and other organisations have been working with Network Rail, and we deliver training to Network Rail staff. Now, it's quite a short course because it's all about just giving them the basic skills and the confidence to go up and start speaking to somebody and then explain to them how to make that journey, you know, the emotional journey from starting a conversation to getting in touch with Samaritans. As a result of Network Rail staff receiving this training, England's now the only country in the whole world where suicides on the railway are reducing. And for every, unfortunately, there are still people who do take their own lives on the railway. But for everyone who does take that course of action, there's 6 to 7 people who are saved every day as a result of this training and as a result of people intervening.
Yeah. And is there any sense to you why the and I'm wary of sort of talking about this, but why the rail network has become this hot spot? People know of, you know, notorious areas, problem areas as well. And I guess, you know, the police and ambulance services will be aware of these areas, and, you know, certain crossings have been closed and bridges have been put into place and things like that. But is it a cultural thing? It's just something that people associate with, or it's a big area, it's a well-known area? What would be the reasons?
So it's certainly not the most common method for somebody to take their own life, and I wouldn't want to raise awareness about them in any way. But what's great is that the partnership has identified ways we can intervene when people go along to these places. Given the nature of a rail system, it is public and it is easy access, and it's also very dangerous.
Yeah.
And there's no way around that, because the only way to board a train is to stand on a platform. So we can't remove that system. That's how we get about.
And I guess the important thing to say is of those suicides, a huge number, a small proportion are based around the rail network. But actually those connections, those interactions might be the most public of some of those things. They might be the most public areas where people might be able to think, there might be a chance to interject here. There might be an opportunity to help change somebody's mind, to point them in the right direction, to get them in help and to get them speaking to the expert people like yourself.
Certainly, and it could just be your colleague who you sit next to every day, or somebody else in the office who you may notice isn't behaving quite the way they normally do. It could be anyone who we encounter in our day-to-day lives. Just starting that conversation, you're not then taking on the responsibility to save that person, but that small action could be the thing that makes the world of difference to somebody who is considering taking their own life. And just knowing they have someone to talk to or that help is out there will make all the difference.
If there's anyone listening to this now, David, and they're thinking, actually, no, I would like to at least know what that first question should be. I would at least like to hear the experiences of people like Sarah that you talked about. On your website, you got the information as well. Network Rail and the British Transport Police are supporting this as well. Where can they find out more information about this?
Firstly, I'd look on our website and the YouTube channel. So I watched a video about Sarah's story just before we came on, and watching it for the second time is very emotional still. People can, you know, in terms of questions people may ask, it can be simple as, my name's David, how are you today, or where are you off to, or is there anything on your mind? You know, it's giving people the opportunity to start a conversation. They may not want to, and that's okay, but always remembering that Samaritans is there 24 hours a day on 116 123. It's a 6-digit number, it's easy to remember, and it's free to call from any phone. Having those both bits of information to hand can really make the difference.
David Ashton, brilliant. Thank you for your time from the Liverpool Samaritans. Don't forget, Mental Health Monday, available as a podcast to download every Monday. And we're keeping on until the end of the year and well into 2018 as well. Plenty more shows already planned, but if you want to get on board and share your story, maybe there's a thought that you've had listening to the programme today, drop us an email. You can email me, mick@radiocity.co.uk. That's mick@radiocity.co.uk. Thank you to everybody who does get involved with the programme and share their thoughts as well. If it's an email that you want me to read out, then brilliant. If it's an email that you'd like to be a guest on the show, absolutely fantastic. Or if it's just your thoughts, more than happy to read them. Mick@radiocity.co.uk and Mental Health Monday back next week on Radio City Talk.
Radio City Talks Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.